Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in it, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In our last episode, we finished up the O section with the fearsome Atug and the owl, giant, and a little bit of the owlbear, but not really. In today's episode, we're cracking open the P section, and we're talking about the Pegasus, the Periton, the Piercer, and possibly, depending on how much time we have, the Pike, giant. Just a quick reminder before we get started, don't forget that the 50th episode mailbag special is coming up. So if you have some thoughts about one of the episodes or some topics that you'd like me to discuss, or if you just want to tell me about your favorite monster, get in touch. The addresses you can do so on Twitter or via email are at the end of this episode. All right, let's start with the Pegasus. Now, of course, in mythology, there's no the Pegasus. There's no sort of like a Pegasus. There's just Pegasus. And Pegasus, together with his brother Chryseion, is the child of Medusa, who springs from her dead body, which is pretty grotesque. And that means that his father is Poseidon, who is not only the god of the sea, but also the god of earthquakes and horses, appropriately here. And we talked about this a little bit back when we talked about Medusa. Pegasus goes up to heaven. He's told to go back down to earth by Zeus. He's found and ridden around by the hero Bellerophon. And he's a pretty frequent topic in Greek art, and you can see why. The idea of a horse that can fly is pretty much the ultimate sort of dream of fast movement and freedom. Now, this makes Pegasus a very interesting artistic symbol, and as a result, he appears, really ever since then, in different kinds of sculpture and painting and so on, because it's just such a cool image and therefore like represents so many different possible ideas. But in a game, Pegasuses, or some people say Pegasi, I realize that's probably not actually correct, because it's Greek, not Latin, right? But who cares? Pegasi are kind of challenging. If we want to give characters winged horses, and that is, I mean, let's be frank, that's what's going to happen. If you introduce winged horses into your game, immediately player characters are going to go, well, I want to catch one and ride it around. And this goes double because the Monster Manual tells us that once they have become your steed, a Pegasus will serve until they die. They're very loyal. So the problem of the Pegasus is basically the problem of magical steeds in general. If you give just one of the player characters a horse that can fly, I hope you like running two games at once, because Flyboy is going to fly his way to every single part of the scenario. Swamp full of troglodytes in the way? Pegasus. Wizard at the top of a tall tower? Pegasus. The only thing that makes it okay to give a Pegasus to one character is if you find yourself, you know, at that, you're toward, you know, the end, you're in a high level campaign, and a lot of the other characters, your magic user types, have already got means of flying, right? So once you get to a high level, whether that's, you know, flying spells or summoning air elementals or whatever, you might very well wind up with a group of characters who can effectively fly and some hapless fighter or barbarian who has to lumber around on the ground. And under those circumstances, it makes sense to have that character get a hold of a Pegasus. But otherwise, one Pegasus basically makes one character feel like she's Captain Awesome, and the rest of the characters feel like a bunch of scrubs. But giving all of them Pegasuses is just overkill. An entire party of characters riding around on Pegasuses, you know, Pegasus Squad, I don't know. You would have to almost set up the campaign that way. In a lot of games, Pegasi wind up functioning kind of as fighters, you know, like fighter aircraft. And it almost sort of works, right? Because when you envision somebody riding on the back of a Pegasus, you envision a knight. You know, Pegasus we associate with nobility and beauty and high aspirations. And so that comes with the idea that he's being ridden around by a knight. Like if you look at the Warhammer games, it's Bretonnia that where you get Pegasi, right? With their chivalry and their, you know, plumed helms and their lances and their banners fluttering gaily in the breeze. And we extend that metaphor to fighter pilots. And if you think about World War I, where they're referred to as the Knights of the Air. So you could do a kind of Knights of the Air type campaign where all the characters, whether they were knights or not, were riding around on Pegasi. But other than that, it seems like they're tough to introduce in a way that keeps it fun for everybody. They're not really fun antagonists. I mean, apart from being very, very mobile, they're not terribly powerful. They're a bit buffer than a regular warhorse. And of course, they're more intelligent. But other than that, the only thing is the ability to fly. So I think they're a lot of fun and they are cool in terms of their imagery, but I think they're challenging to implement in a way that doesn't make them the center of the game. If you're riding around on a little bit of a magic horse, or, you know, maybe one of you guys is riding around on a giant tiger or whatever it might be, that's, you know, just a kind of a more characterful horse. But once you introduce a new form of locomotion and give it to only one character, or indeed to everybody, you can wind up with trouble. I'm not against Pegasi. I think, you know, any of these classical monsters has such a depth of, like, familiarity and emotional response to their imagery that they almost always work well. We'll talk a little more about that when we get to our special on the unicorn. But so while Pegasuses are cool, I think there are challenges in implementing them in a fun way. Now, a second ago, I said that classical monsters, particularly these kind of hybrid mythological animals, carry a lot of emotional resonance, and it's really interesting to take a look at our next entry, the Periton, and see how that sort of doesn't work. Because the Periton is very similar to a classical animal, right? It has the hind legs and wings of a bird, and the forelegs, neck, and head of a stag. And it is not, much as it might seem to be, an animal from Greek mythology. It was created by Jorge Luis Borges in The Book of Imaginary Beings, which came out in English, I want to say, in 1969. And it is very clear that this comes directly from there. So if you look at the Periton in the Monster Manual, you'll see that it doesn't have the stag's forelegs. It just has the body of a bird with the head of a stag. But it has a detail in the illustration that comes from the Book of Imaginary Beings, but that isn't in the Monster Manual description, which is that the Periton has the shadow of a man, which is a really cool detail. I love things that have the wrong shadow. That's just such like an easy signifier of a magical nature. Now, the Periton has a man's shadow until it has killed a man, at which point it regains its own Periton shadow. And it adds we also learn some stuff about their reproductive cycle, which involves eating hearts, so that's kind of grim. And I really think that the Book of Imaginary Beings does, in many ways, is kind of a proto-monster manual. Obviously, it's meant to be an attempt at a medieval bestiary. It does this very H.P. Lovecraft thing. This is something that I've talked about Lovecraft doing before, but that's that it combines actual mythology and stuff that's just made up. So there are entries in there for things that are really mythological animals and things that aren't but sound like they might be, like the Periton. And that's kind of the same in the Monster Manual. I'm periodically surprised by things that seem like they should have some folkloric origin, but actually they don't. Peritons are very cool, and they have a cool visual image, but they don't necessarily have the same kind of emotional freight that, you know, say, a Pegasus does. And that's basically because they're not things that have so pervaded our, for lack of a better term, cultural heritage, that we sort of automatically know what they are. So they're great, they're characterful, they're weird, which I really like. They don't have a whole lot of narrative hooks, but they can definitely be interesting. I don't think they're interesting as a random encounter. You know, you should be definitely trying to, you know, explore a ruined temple that's atop this mountain, and also a Periton's lair or nest is up there. Finally, we have the Piercer. When I talk about the Piercer, I feel like I'm talking about the Lurker above, or possibly the Mimic. It's an animal, it lives in dungeons, it has protective coloration that makes it look like a part of a dungeon, and it kills by springing a trap on unsuspecting people who pass beneath it. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's another dungeon hazard monster. And again, I feel like it's these gacha monsters teach the wrong message. One of the things that's interesting about Dungeons & Dragons is the extent to which it encourages a certain type of obsessive play. It's full of little details, it's full of intricacies and nuances, and you can really spend a lot of time on it. And for older gamers, I think this can be challenging because, particularly if you didn't grow up with it, if you don't have all of these nuances mastered, I mean, how much time have you got? So that type of gameplay where every new chamber you're entering, you're checking to see if it's full of piercers or lurkers above, or whether every piece of furniture is a mimic, etc., etc. I understand that that's challenging, but I think in like a fun-to-time ratio kind of way, it's not necessarily very rewarding, but that there is some kind of special reward that comes only from making that kind of obsessive time commitment. But the question is largely academic, because I don't think most of us have that kind of time. So I feel like these monsters encourage a very slow style of play, and therefore if you're going to use them, you have to include some kind of contextual clue. You know, oh, we found this chamber where there was a guy who had been killed by being stabbed from above, but there were no tracks that suggest that an assailant was near him, kind of thing. Even something as simple as that, to give away the piercer, I think makes it fair play. Otherwise, you will get the behavior you encourage, and you don't actually want that. Anyway, other than that, piercers are fun, although they kind of suffer sort of from their position in the monster manual, by which I mean simply that their gimmick has already been done by two other monsters at this point, and they just kind of seem like more of the same. I do like the idea of creatures that naturally look like stalactites, because they're sort of, you know, that's their camouflage. They blend in among stalactites. I assume they move very slowly, which is how they get back up to cave ceilings. Anyway, they're fun, and they're by now a recognizable part of the Dungeons & Dragons dungeon ecology, but since I don't like to make my dungeons recognizably dungeons, they're something I avoid, but there's definitely a place for them. Piercers can be fun. All right, let's go for it. I said that the piercer was going to be our last one, but actually I think we have got time to talk about the pike, giant. Now, a pike is a kind of fish. It has a long, thin body with a sort of long, pointy snout full of sharp teeth, which is why the name pike comes from. It's from the same root word as, like, pike in the sense of a spear, and pick, like a pickaxe, which, you know, refers to the shape of its face. You may remember the gar, giant. Gar, of course, comes from a root word that means spear, and refers to the fish's long, thin body and head, and it's got a long, narrow mouth full of teeth, and these are giant versions, and look, they're basically the same. The giant pike is like the giant gar, only not quite as tough. It's got one higher AC, one fewer die of damage. It's just a slightly smaller giant gar. Now, I realize that gar and pike are different species, but we really have two entries for very slightly different giant elongated predatory freshwater fish. I mean, I'll give you the barracuda, because barracudas are real and have great bitey teeth, and they're saltwater species. But these are very similar to one another. Now, I think that probably the gar, giant might be the more American sense of it, but if you live in the UK, then probably pike, giant is going to be your go-to, because, of course, pike are, in fact, fish that you get around here. Maybe they're a gar, I don't know, I don't fish. The only reason I really know about pike is because there's this famous poem about them, Pike by Ted Hughes. And if you want to make your pike seem menacing, I recommend it as the go-to, even though it also talks about how they're not very big. Includes lines like, pike 3 inches long, perfect, pike in all parts, green tigering the gold, killers from the egg, the malevolent aged grin, they dance on the surface among the flies. Or move, stunned by their own grandeur, over a bed of emerald, silhouette of submarine delicacy and horror, 100 feet long in their world. So this idea that pike would be terrifying predators if they were really big, and hey, the pike, giant is really big. There's nothing wrong with the pike, giant. Pike are mean-looking little fish, and the poem is pretty good, and if you wanted to have a giant dangerous fish, the pike, giant, which we are informed are sometimes tamed by Nixies, which is kind of a neat image, those are all pretty interesting ideas. And my only real objection to it is that it is almost exactly the same as the gar, giant, and that feels a little excessive. But hey, better excessive than not enough, right? The Monster Manual runs on excess, and we should celebrate that. So, pike, giant, you're okay. But really, would a single section called fish, giant have killed you? That's it for this episode. Tune in next time for the Pixie, the Porcupine, Giant, and the Portuguese Man-O-War on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the Deities and Demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.